In this edition of the Writer's Gym podcast, we are going to be testing one of the most common phrases that writers might hear, and that is write what you know. I recently edited an interview with the actor and now novelist Patterson Joseph, who had done lots and lots of research for a novel about someone who had lived 200 years ago. And in that interview, Patterson Joseph said, "I think we need to reconsider write what you know." And that's what we're going to be talking about in this edition of the podcast with Rachel Knightley.
Hello.
And Emily Inkpen.
Hello.
Welcome to the Writer's Gym podcast. The Writer's Gym podcast. Build creative confidence and grow your writing life with Rachel Knightley and Emily Inkpen. So, write what you know. First of all...
I was just about to say, I know chuffle.
Well, I think we kind of all think that, don't we?
We can all think that until we realise that what is obvious to us is a completely other world to the person sitting next to us.
Yes, exactly.
Which is why, arguably, we write.
Mm. Yes.
Well, my first question was going to be, can, in inverted commas, what you know... be replaced by doing lots of research, which is what Patterson Joseph did in preparation for writing his novel.
I feel like for me, when I hear that, I go down the opposite trouser leg of meaning, to bend another Pratchett image. Write what you know never meant autobiography. Mm. By extension, it never meant specifically the examples, the locations. For me, what's most important about this is understanding that it's not literal. Mm-hmm. For example, when I was ready to deal with a domestic violence incident that had been part of my history, I fictionalised the specifics, but I kept the essential truth that I believed was an important story to talk about, mm-hmm. which was to do with domestic violence and gender and how perception was different and issues around that, which I felt very strongly needed to be talked about. There needed to be more discourse on it. Mm-hmm. So I changed the specifics. I fictionalised a bunch of stuff, but I kept the issue I wanted to talk about in itself within that text. You could argue, I guess, that I did research it because, for example, when I had anti-Semitic emails that the police said send us the emails and the police computer refused to accept the emails because of the language in the emails, even then I had the police standing around me going, how do we get you to forward the emails? Mm. The amusement of it, the irony of it, the you couldn't make it up factor. Yes, I did research it. I did live through it. I was drawing on first-hand experience. And had I needed other characters, I'd have needed to give them different experience. I might have researched more. But for me, it's about identifying cart and horse and which one you put first. Mm-hmm. What are you trying to say? What are you trying to explore? What do you need in order to have the courage and curiosity to do that and help yourself with that? But it's not for me about write what you know, as in I can only write dual identity, vegan Londoners who are 5 foot. You know, it's not about that. For example, if I'm dealing with a disability, the experience of having one that nobody else can see. Mm. Sometimes you can write it more directly by changing the specifics of it. Mm. You get more of a freedom in yourself when you're not being exactly autobiographical. Because the thing about being exactly autobiographical is suddenly there's a right and wrong answer again. There's a true and a false.
Yes.
And that's what you don't need when you're fictionalizing. When you're reaching for the emotional truth, you do not want to be imprisoned by the literal truth. You want to find a way to free yourself, to find the unique story, the unique question that you have that this fiction or memoir, or whatever it happens to be, is there to communicate.
Mm. Emily, I mean, your interpretation of the phrase, write what you know, I mean, do you think that research can kind of fill in the gaps in knowledge, or...?
It can definitely, I think, yes. I think that, as Rachel was saying, which I think is correct, is that you are always telling a story that is true, or your story has to have truth. The details need to be very, very well researched. If you've got a character and you're setting out to tell the story of this character, and then in your research you find out that this character would never be like you've written or like you thought they would be, if they had in fact originated in this environment. That's where things become interesting, I would say, because it's like world building. It's world building again. We've discussed this before about your characters are absolutely of their world. You need to make sure that they are embedded in that. If you don't know anything about that world, I think you need to know a bit about that world before you get too attached to the character traits and the characteristics of the person who's leading your story, or at least be prepared to add layers to them. And maybe in the spirit of killing some darlings, get rid of some characteristics that you thought at the beginning would be absolutely essential to them. But in the course of research, sometimes you realize that instead of this thing that you thought they would be like, they're actually like this because of these things instead. And that can be a more authentic way of forming their character and forming their motivations. So yes, I think that research can definitely fill in the gaps. Sometimes research can steer more than that.
Yes.
I don't know if any of that made sense.
I think it did. I mean, so I would follow up with the question, is the purpose of our research to make our piece more entertaining, more believable, more convincing to our audience? Or is it to convince us as writers that we are representing people in situations as accurately and faithfully as possible?
Again, accurately and faithfully, I think, is quite dangerous to a fiction writer. Your experience of another human being will be different to the experience of any other person experiencing that human being because they're a different person themselves or because it was a different time. All we can ever do is be faithful to our own versions. And this is particularly important in memoir. I've had clients or students come to me and say they're nervous about memoir, and the way that they've responded to that is by maybe managing a couple of pages and immediately asking the people that are actually figuring in these stories, is this all right? And the thing is, if it isn't cooked yet, you're essentially presenting something that doesn't know what it is yet and saying to that person, I want to use personal material. Now, in that situation, it's not in anybody's best interest to say, yes, I wouldn't. As a writing coach, though, what I'd be saying is, I can't yet see what story is in there for you. And until I see that, the conversation's a little bit meaningless. It's you finding what it is you want to tell. So I think it was Goethe, I may be wrong. I want to tell you my stories to find out if they are true. That sense of curiosity, of not coming in going, I'm right, everybody else in the universe is wrong, and this memoir is my proof, but a discovery of self, a discovery of a journey, a vulnerability, where you don't have full control of it. You are telling your story in order to find out what you think and what you feel, which is why coming to the blank page with curiosity rather than a sense of I have to find the right answer is so vital. I think
there's a certain amount of asking permission. I mean, if you go to a family member with a couple of pages and saying, is it okay if I use material in this that you might appear in? You're basically asking them to sign off on an unknown quantity.
Exactly.
They don't know what the product's going to be. They don't know what story you're telling. And you're just expecting them to give carte blanche right to just use anything, tell any story. And then at the end of it, they're going to say, well, here it is. And they're going to be upset and that you're going to say, well, you know, I asked your permission back when I had a page and a half and you said yes.
Yeah.
That's not a fair position to put anybody in, let alone yourself. And I think there's a certain amount of, if you're at the beginning of writing something like a memoir that's really, really personal, and it's scary because, like you're saying, it's going on a personal voyage of discovery. Maybe the asking of permission is almost like asking yourself permission, but you're outsourcing that to a family member.
This is exactly what I made sure that I was a qualified coach for my writers. That was why I went and did that, because in order to have full access to your emotions, that does mean coming across some difficult stuff, because in order to come to yourself for the permission rather than somebody else, that often takes a lot of self-esteem work.
Yeah.
It's much easier to do our best to put our authority in somebody else. Is this all right? Is this all right? Is this all right? And that's a black hole that you can never fill.
Yeah.
You need to have that permission from yourself in order to move forward with it.
And ultimately, they may never give you the permission, and then where are you?
And then the world loses, because only you can write what you can write. It will not be here in all of time and space unless you write it, to paraphrase Martha Graham a lot.
So let's move on a little bit then and come at the question from a slightly different angle. One of my challenges to write what you know is simply this. what do we actually know? I mean, we've talked in previous podcasts about unreliable narrators,
yeah.
the ability for two different human beings to see completely different things in the same situation,
mm-hmm.
to recollect things incorrectly. So what do we know? Is it even a valid question or a statement then, if we can't be sure of what we know? And this is getting very philosophical.
We know what it's like to be ourselves, and sometimes we don't even know that.
Mm.
Which again is why embracing subjectivity and not looking for an objective right or wrong answer is so crucial to being any kind of writer. On the first series of The Writer's Gym, I interviewed Dan Coxon, the author and editor, and we were talking about how every writer has one piece of common writing advice that irritates the bejesus out of them. And his wasn't write what you know, it was write every day. That was the one that annoyed him, because of course there are people for whom
writing every day
pressure,
is impossible.
Yeah, the pressure is not right for them. I think for me, write what you know doesn't irritate me in my understanding of it, but if people were saying that that meant you had to do research, I think, as much as I adore Patterson Joseph, that is where we would differ. Because, yes, sometimes research is vital, but sometimes the opposite of research is vital.
Mm.
Mining for primary evidence from yourself
yeah.
is vital, and that is why the writer's gym is the writer's gym. You need that weightlifting, you need that practice, that resilience builds, that strength, confidence, focus. These things all build when you do them a little bit regularly.
Just
not all
constantly.
At once. Yeah.
But it's a constant process of learning to access your inner reserves. One thing that I would say about research is that you can only research what has been written before.
Mm.
And sometimes what has been written before is telling a very specific story. I have done research before where I've realized that the only material I can find is all by men.
Mm.
And I'm only hearing half of the story. And I'm not hearing quite a vital component of the story there. The things that they say about the women present tell a very different story from their point of view. You know, I know that then if we were hearing from the women in that situation, we would get a very different view of life in that place that I am researching. Sometimes the materials that you have available to you are skewed. And I think that being aware of where the gaps are in available research is also very important. Because not only do you have to sort of then say, okay, well, are there any materials that will fill in this gap? But you have to be prepared for the fact that there might not be. And then you have to be prepared for the fact that maybe you are going to have to just bring some authenticity from within, you know, try and fill out those things with the caveat that you might not be able to. We can only do what we can.
And we can look at why we're doing it
yeah.
as well, that which I know we'll be talking about this in a bit anyway, but whose story is it to tell
mm-hmm.
is always a tripping point if you're having self-confidence issues. Your version of whatever you've experienced is yours to tell.
Yeah.
Your power is always to fictionalise any aspect you want to keep the emotional truth, to explore whatever it is you want to explore. But you are in charge. Only you can write it. Only you can free yourself to write it. That really is the freedom, is you decide what the parameters are.
Mm.
Yeah.
Moving on from there then, would there ever be an instance for either of you where you absolutely wouldn't write about a particular topic because you didn't feel that you knew it or knew enough about it?
One of the benefits of being a science fiction writer and writing in different worlds is that you are the one who knows that world.
Mm.
You own it. You own the stories within it. I find that very much more difficult in the real world setting, in our Earth world setting, when it comes to stories from perspectives that I have no experience in. And I know the diversity of perspectives that exist, and should I be the one to tell certain stories?
Mm.
And I think that there are some stories out there. Yes, I could think of a story that I could tell about refugee going on a horrifically dangerous journey across an ocean and landing on an alien shore. I could tell a story like that on Earth.
Mm.
But should I?
Yeah.
And I don't think that I necessarily should. I don't think that I've got enough in me to bring authenticity to that story.
Mm.
And even if I did research it, I could fill in all of those gaps. But at the end of the day, you have to think about it like from the point of view of, I am privileged in our society in many ways. I am more likely, therefore, for my work telling this story to get places, to get representation, to get publication. But there's only so many places on a publication list for a story like that. Is that place mine to fill? Mm. Is that place mine to claim? Or should it be claimed by somebody who has more authenticity in that story, who has a more authentic view on it? Am I the one who's going to be taking up space there when I shouldn't be? And there are lots of stories at the end of the day. I can come up with lots of stories. Maybe there are stories out there that you look at and say, maybe not this one.
Mm.
And the Piquet Avot quote, it is not for you to complete the work, but nor is it for you to abstain from it. You won't tell every story that's in you. You
exactly.
won't write every injustice. So you pick where you think you can do the best with the talents, interests, abilities that are available to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, every time a certain political area of all our lives comes up, I feel enormously torn, and I feel that my silence in not saying one prime minister does not a government make, one government does not a country make, not all of that country think the same thing, issues getting polarised. I'm suffering from that, and a lot of people are suffering from that on both sides every day. And unfortunately, because we are storytelling animals as human beings, it does get polarised. People want cartoon goodies and baddies. I talk about Jewish ethics. I talk about what it is that has inspired and motivated me to do what good I am doing in my life. I don't have an answer to this, but I keep asking myself the question, and I think that's the important thing, is what stories am I ready to tell? So the domestic violence one, I certainly wasn't ready to tell that one the week it happened.
No.
But I was ready to tell it when I was ready to tell it. Frankly, I think I wasn't as ready as I thought I was, and maybe if I did it now, it might be cooked all the way through. But as we said in the last episode, there is a sort of time element to all of this. You might not be ready to tell a story, or you might, as Emily said, not be the person to tell a story. Listen to your gut, listen to what you can do wholeheartedly.
Mm.
Because for me, I guess it's about showing up wholeheartedly. If you're doing something because you think you should, inverted commas, you're probably not telling it authentically anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Follow yeah. your curiosity, follow your interest, listen to yourself.
Yeah, and I think the element there that we're talking about is time. Sometimes you need a bit more time to come at a story.
Mm.
If you're telling a story that's not necessarily, you don't necessarily think it's yours to tell, but you're telling it anyway because you think, oh, I've done a lot of research. Mm. At some point, you're going to find yourself on a panel, or you're going to find yourself in front of an audience of people, and those people are going to ask questions. And if you can't answer the questions, and if you can't answer your audience, what are you going to do in that moment?
Mm.
You know?
That's coming from a place where you've experienced panels and you've had a lot of writing go into the world and it's more familiar. Given that I think probably you, certainly me, probably most people will always find a way to think, I'm not worthy, I'm the imposter, I shouldn't be here anyway.
Yeah.
How do you balance that? Because at some level, everything I ever do, I could go, oh, but what if I'm on a panel and then I can't... Do you see what I mean?
No. See, what I'm sort of saying there, I get exactly what you mean. So when I was writing book one, which, by the way, is still in submission for publishers, so it's not, you know, like... But when I was writing that, I had a friend ask me some questions and I couldn't answer them. Now, what that taught me is that I didn't not have the answers. It's that I hadn't asked them of myself yet.
Mm.
And I needed to. Mm. And then I knew what the answers were. And then I would be prepared. You've got to think of the questions that they're going to ask. And then you've got to think, will I believe my own answer? Do I stand by my own answer? If somebody stood up and asked me something very probing about this, and I responded, would I be able to respond with confidence, or would I feel like I'm making an excuse?
So it's kind of, have I done everything I can do?
Yeah.
Before it comes into a wider world?
Exactly. And you won't have all of the answers, let's face it. But if you are dealing with things that are tricky subjects, for instance, you know that you might be putting your book into the world or whatever you've made, and it's touching on points that are quite sensitive. You need to think about why you're doing it and how you're doing it. And you need to be able to justify how you've done it.
You need to be comfortable with how you've...
Yes.
Just not justify it to somebody else first, but to yourself.
To yourself first.
Yes.
so that you can stand by yourself and your work when the time comes, because it will be questioned.
Yeah.
It will be questioned. And that's how you know that it's authentic, and that's how you know you've done a good job, is if you first interrogate it. I think that's what I'm saying. You need to interrogate yourself first and ask yourself these really difficult questions related to your work. And then you know that whatever person stands up and says, why did you do this? I found it really difficult or really unrealistic that this thing happened. And you've got an answer. You've got a reason.
You've got the truth.
You've got the truth.
And not everyone will agree with you, because human and life.
But at least you will believe
you have that.
And you will be able to leave that panel thinking, I still believe in this work, and I still believe in where I stand beside it, you know.
Or even if your mind does change, which it might.
It might change, yeah.
That's still from a place of authenticity, because you're showing up with what is true to you.
Yeah, and if you get asked a question like that and you say, I have thought about this, when I wrote it, I thought this, latterly, I have thought this other thing. What the audience is trying to gain is an idea of whether or not you've thought about it.
Yeah.
Or you've done it by accident and you've been careless.
Yeah.
And that's what, especially if it's a sensitive issue, have you handled this with thought, or have you just thrown it out there because you thought it would be shocking, or, you know, because you wanted to
look cool.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what they're testing sometimes. Yeah. You got to be able to say, no, I thought about it. And yeah, even if your point of view does change, showing that it has, it's important. It is important, I think.
I mean, it strikes me that there is something here about nuance that knowledge can give us a perspective. And going back to something you said, Rachel, about the way that the press sometimes reports things, and it's very black and white. You are either on this side or that side. And I think that we as writers of fiction should be better than that.
Yes.
And I think the danger sometimes in not knowing enough is that we create caricatures.
Yeah.
That we create characters that are either goodies or baddies. There's no, there's nothing in between. So do you think then that there is this, you are able to be more nuanced the more you know?
You're able to be more nuanced the more you acknowledge that people are three-dimensional. And this is why I found writing that antagonist so useful for me. To give the example I was using before, the stalker example, the real life stimulus which I wanted to explore was that this particular person saw me as the epitome of evil, because I was A, Jewish, and she was anti-Semitic, and B, I was a teacher at the time, which was something that she had wanted to do and she couldn't, and C, I was with the man that she considered hers. I did not see it that way when I got with the man, but she very much did. And I represented evil to her. Now, she, as a physically violent anti-Semite, represented pure evil to me. And even as I was going through all that stuff I mentioned, the writer part of me was going, pay attention. This needs to be talked about.
There's something in this.
There's something in this. And it is that, but it's the story is calling you. When a story calls you, listen. Because I could have just quietly not. I did fictionalise it. I changed every actual detail for something else, except for the core of it. And I changed the race as well, and I changed the nationalities and geographies involved and everything. But the essential was still there. Because, as I said, it was a story I absolutely felt in my gut needed to be explored by me as soon and as deeply as possible.
Yeah.
And that's what I think you're listening for as a writer.
Yeah. A bad place to start from, I think, is thinking, I want to write a book, and I want to write a book that is about an important thing, and I want it to be an important thing that will capture the current mood and
the
climate.
Zeitgeist.
The current zeitgeist. I want it to do that. So what's important to people now?
What's the recipe for the zeitgeist on a plate?
Exactly. And I shall write that. And it never really goes well.
No.
You can tell those books, and don't be that person. Just don't be that person. I'm not even going to go into the whys. I think we've been covering the whys. Just
it sort of overlaps with the reason for the vomit draft in a way, but with ideas as well, which is, you know, if you need to vomit, you don't think, where in my diary can I pencil in vomiting?
Mm.
You know, you don't have that freedom when it comes to it. It has to come out.
Nope.
And in the same way, I think Chris is getting quite bored with this image, but I promise this is the last time. one of the things that it does is, if your story is in you to tell, that's a very different sensation to what's interesting, racking your brains instead of going, actually, this stuff is already in me, and with a little bit of courage, and if I drop all my shoulds about what I should be writing, what comes out?
Yes. Mm. And this is the thing, it's like, what's already inside me, what is already there, that is also gold there. Mm. And it's being able to interrogate that. Mm. And bring that out in.
Vomit the gold.
There only we go. The gold. We pan for gold in the... I'm not going to go into that.
I mean, I will say, as a health warning, you can't only vomit gold.
Wow, well, not with that attitude.
Love it. But you vomit, and some of it will be gold, and the trick is to mine for it, I think.
It's to look for it in the... Yeah, let's
I'm going to move this on a little bit.
Do you know,
bit.
Some people get triggered by talking about vomit. I'm just...
You do.
We should probably put a trigger warning in the
trigger
notes.
Trigger warning, yeah. Vomit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's move away from that then. And I want to talk a little bit about characters, because, you know, from the classical perspective of what we know, we can't know what it is like to be other people.
Mm.
Yet our books would be very dull if we were the only character or the only perspective in them.
Well, I don't know.
Well, possibly. I mean, you maybe have a much more interesting mind than mine, but mine would be a very dull book and mostly involve coffee and biscuits. But
sold.
I'd read it. Yeah.
So let's think about characters then.
Yeah.
How do we, with Write What You Know hanging over our heads, write characters?
Can I say my one? Because this is quite a special one to me. I find that I write much more freely by distancing myself from myself in one capacity or another. So, for example, I find writing as male enormously helpful, because I just get on with being the person, and it's a sort of reminder that's hovering over my head that it's not me, but I've got access to all of me.
Mm.
So taking Wolf in the Mirror, that is in my first collection, that won first prize in Writers Forum, and that was the first sort of encouragement I had in that area. And that was writing as male in a pub in Richmond that exists, but I geographically moved all of the bits. And I mentioned earlier in another episode that the staircase that I have something happen on, it wouldn't have happened on because he's male and he wouldn't have been going down there because the way to the ladies is. But it's me using geography, using sensations from my memory and my imagination, but in another person's body, in another person's mind. Evens the playing field. It makes you know that you've got access to all of you, but you've also got the full freedom of you've got full freedom to be somebody else.
Mm.
So I have people come to me and say, I can't possibly write as a man because I'm a woman. We're completely different.
Yeah.
And here's the news. You're not. How you respond to things might be, but most of us, I would say, have friends of all places on gender spectrums and will be like this person in one way and unlike that person in one way. And, you know, we've got different things in common with every single friend we have. Finding the uniqueness is about finding that we are all the same. We are all motivated by fears, anxieties, hopes, passions. We've got all of those ingredients. Yes, you'll have to see how this one individual human expresses them. But acknowledging that we all have the same fundamental ingredients in there is something that builds my confidence, actually. It reminds me that every reader and every potential character have a little piece of me in them.
Yeah. Mm. I think that when it comes to characters and sort of writing what I know, I mean, I guess this is where also some research elements do sort of feed into it, because I sort of refer to living life on a daily basis as experience harvesting. You're going around, and everything that you interact with and see and observe and all of those things all go into this big melting pot. And at some point, I'm not going to use the previous metaphor.
No,
but
no.
You turn a knob and something original comes out.
You process. Oh no,
we're not going to go.
That's
there.
Worse.
Trying to say something like, but whatever the ingredients are that are all mashed around in your head, something original comes out of them. And so every single character is from you, but also from your perspectives on other people and their characters, and all of the things you've read, you've watched, you've seen, you've observed, you've interacted with, all of these things are ingredients that go into the characters that we write. Ultimately, they all come from your view of the characters that you've seen in a movie, the characters you've read in that book, the person that you met at that party. All of that is your perspective on all of those things.
Mm.
So technically, all of them come from an intrinsically you space that you know, but they are all a diverse set of ingredients that come from all over the place.
And it's still the way that I talk about it as mixing colours on your palette, that no painter is ever going to think, oh, I couldn't possibly mix that shade and that shade. Somebody might not like it.
Yeah.
They're going to mix the colours, and we've got these memories, these imaginations, observations, questions about the world, and we need to mix them freely. And yeah, absolutely, every day you add new
material.
Nuance, shades.
Yeah. I call it fodder. It's all creative fodder.
Mm.
You know, somebody does something obnoxious to me in the shop and I'm really miffed about it, and I'm like, oh, that's fodder for later.
I love that.
There was a scene in the most recent Richard Osman Thursday Murder Club novel in which the main character, who is female and a person living in a retirement home and an ex-spy,
mm-hmm.
is confronted by her husband, who has progressive dementia, with a letter that somebody has written to him. And Elizabeth has been trying to stop Stephen from realising that he has dementia and trying to cheery over when he leaves the taps on. You know, it's becoming more and more dangerous. And somebody's written this letter to him saying, and we're in Elizabeth's mind, and Elizabeth's getting angrier and angrier about who could know him so well, but also who could be so heartless as to send it. Until we realise that, of course, it's Stephen, and Stephen's written this letter to himself and hidden it, and it gets to the point where he's reading it every day. It is one of the most affecting scenes I have ever met. It remains a light, cosy crime, funny, beautiful book. Richard Osman is not the age, or, as far as I know, an ex-spy that Elizabeth is, but my God, it's being human on a stick.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's what we're aiming for.
I mean, moving on then from characters that we observe and interact with in our writing, what about writing from the perspective of different characters so that they become our narrators, our main characters? What do you have thoughts on that?
I've talked about jumping into other genders, other locations, things like that. I find that enormously liberating in order to use it as a master key to everything about me.
Yeah.
Is it like that for you, Emily, or is it different?
I don't really know. I've been talking about interrogating your truth and writing your novels. This is a very good question. The main points of view that I work from, apart from the novels that I've got that are going on around the size, are from the point of view of Varian, Isra and Ren, and that's two boys and a girl. So Varian and Ren are the boys, and then we've got Isra.
Mm.
And actually the one I identify with most is Ren. He's a glorious mess of an individual and very layered.
You don't write in the first person as Ren, though?
No, do you? I don't. I write, it's very close third person.
Yeah.
So we only really know what's going on in his head from a point of view position and through his eyes, as it were, but it's not first person. Same with all of them. Yeah, do I find that liberating? I guess I do. I find the whole science fiction genre, I find being in my own world intrinsically liberating, because it's mine and I own it and it's all me, and you know, and that is empowering, I think, and it frees you from a lot of sort of the crap that we live with on a day-to-day basis in this world. I can make up my own crap that people are living with in that world, and I own it, and I know how to deal with it, and I know how to not deal with it, as the case may be. I don't even know where to start with half the crap that's going on in this world.
But isn't sci-fi, though, in its best form, a lens through which we can view our own world?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It is. Essentially, yes. None of my world is original. Let's just say that. it is an original world, but none of it is actually original because all of the ingredients were real and all of the ingredients came from the world that we live in and the people that are in it and the real, real people that and things that I've
mixing the colours.
Exactly. It's arranged in my world in a original way, but it is not in itself original. If you look at any of the ingredients on their own, anything in isolation, you know exactly where it's come from. It's not doing anything particularly extreme. And that means, yes, it is holding up a mirror to our world, but being in the reflection is a point of removal. And that in itself is freeing.
That's what it feels like for me. And it's what I've always loved about science fiction. I was hugely influenced by science fiction. And because I was brought up by a single mum who was brought up with, we're Jewish and she's a scientist. And I'd have friends with religious backgrounds going as if you couldn't be religious and scientific, as if these were
mutually
opposite.
Exclusive.
And it was never like that in my upbringing. It was never, are these stories literal? If they did happen a long time ago, okay, fine, lovely. But it's absolutely not the point. It's what do these stories tell me about my life and my potential and my possibility and how I react to other people, which is why I studied English literature. It's why I'm a writer. It's how I think. And science fiction has always been the best place for that. You know, the influence of Star Trek and how we do against all of our best intentions survive through all the nonsense in order to get beyond money and get beyond war on our planet and move through the world in a spirit of discovery rather than combat was enormously revolutionary at the time. I was also very interested and remain very interested in everything Douglas Adams saw coming in terms of technology, but also saw all the way around him about humans managing to get down from the trees, out of the water in the first place, but still thinking digital watches are a pretty neat idea. The humour of the universe. Science fiction is a great place to be.
Yeah.
But the things that it does, you can do in the natural world as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a playground. And I often say that science fiction as a genre very rarely says no. Yeah. And it's absolutely true. You can be as philosophical as you like. You can explore political ideas, societal ideas, you know, psychological ideas. You can go wherever you want, in any direction, in any galaxy, in whatever amount of detail you want to do it in, and with whatever motives. And it's just an enormous playground. Space is big.
Yeah.
Like, really big.
And it's, I guess it's a...
You simply won't believe how mind-numbingly...
You might think it's a long way from here to the chemist.
But that's just peanuts to space.
I do apologise to the estate of Douglas Adams. But
it's like being 10 again.
I mean, it's all about, I guess, testing humanity, isn't it? Testing the human condition in environments that we can't put it in on Earth, or that are proxies for environments on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do basically run simulation over here.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a scenario. Run simulation. How would it play out? You can take societal structures and say, okay, theoretically, like Ursula Le Guin does in The Dispossessed, anarchism. All right, fine. Anarchism, society. How would that work? Let's stick them on a moon as an actual society, several generations in. What does this look like? And you get to actually look at it and play it out, her version of what it is. And it's interesting. It's an opportunity. You couldn't do that telling a story in the modern world because too much of what is in our world would interrupt it.
And when people get too literal and when people think that writing what you know means writing literally what you think about that, they'll go for the example and not the issue.
Yeah.
Whereas when you write about people in space having those conversations, perhaps we could argue that's more useful because then we have the option of being universal, of saying something about the human condition rather than specific humans within it.
Yes, absolutely.
What a great point to end our discussion on write what you know.
Oh, so at the end? I was just getting started. Turns out I know a lot. No, I don't.
It's literally one of those where we could do a part two, couldn't we? And maybe we will at some point. But we always end these podcasts with a challenge or an exercise. Rachel, what have you got for us today?
I dare you to take a conversation slash argument that is playing on your mind. You already know what it is, so stop thinking about it and start listening to what you're already thinking. It's playing on your mind because you've got something you want to think through about it. Write down a few of the words from it, and then fill in the scene from the other person's point of view. You're not you in this scene, you're the other person. You don't ever have to show it to anybody, but do be honest with the piece of paper. Mm. Be the other person in the argument. Fictionalise them as much as you like. Fictionalise yourself as much as you like. And see what you discover without judgment. No judging, just noticing. What do you discover?
I'd like to challenge a few politicians with that one, but...
wouldn't we all?
We don't necessarily have access to them as our audience, but
no.
We do as... for
if we did,
writers.
We don't anymore.
We don't anymore. They've all switched
off
at this point.
They've just switched off.
Yes.
Yeah.
But writers do have a go at that one. That is a great one for kind of examining the other view, the other perspective, and developing that nuance that we talked about earlier. Rachel Knightley, Emily Inkpen, thank you so much for joining us today on the Writers Podcast, Writers Gym Podcast.
It's life gym, but not as we know it.
It's the Writers Gym, but not as we know it.
Thank you, Chris Gregory.
Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to the Writers Gym Podcast with Rachel Knightley, Emily Inkpen, and me, Chris Gregory. If you'd like to learn more about Rachel and the Writers' Gym, please go to rachelknightley.com. To find out more about Emily, please go to emilyinkpen.com. And for Chris, go to alternativestories.com. We'll print all these links and more in the show notes for this podcast. The Writers' Gym Podcast is an Alternative Stories 2024 production for the Writers' Gym. Production, sound design and editing were by me, Chris Gregory.